beginning. We have before us one discipline case. Justice Bradley will not be participating. The chair is empty. I'll call the case 13AP 1619D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Paul Strauss. Representing Attorney Strauss is Attorney Dean Diedrich. Representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Mr. Ryer. Diedrich, you have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And Mr. Ryer, you have 30 minutes. You may proceed, counsel. I should apologize. I know that today was not a very good day for you, Attorney Diedrich, but that we couldn't schedule it any other time, so we appreciate that, but recognize that you requested more time.
I understand, and I thank you, Your Honor, Chief Justice, may it please the Court, members of the Court, my name is Dean Diedrich, and I'm here today with you and with Paul Strauss to make argument as it relates to the OLR proceedings that is before you. I thank you for the opportunity to make oral argument to you today. I feel that this case is one that truly warrants a special review by this Court because of the manner in which this case has proceeded through the entire process. There are several points I will make initially and then expand upon again. I believe that this court must give special consideration to this case because, number one, throughout the course of the case, the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the referee imposes upon Attorney Strauss, and I would submit upon all lawyers from the way that they have phrased their case, that there must be a written fee agreement implying that there is a mutual agreement between the parties regarding the nature and the scope of the representation in writing. That is not what 20:1.5 provides, and I will address that in a moment. Secondly, Justices, this case involves a process that counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation and myself as counsel for Attorney Strauss went through to develop a very sophisticated and comprehensive stipulation of facts. We did that on purpose. We did that for the purpose of expediting the process and having the process be one where the referee would consider the testimony presented and would make rulings regarding the testimony presented. In the findings from the referee, 87% of the findings of the referee are verbatim statements from the stipulation of facts. Now, it's okay to have stipulation of facts, and it's okay to have those included in a findings of fact. But the purpose for a hearing, and by the way, we had a four-day hearing on this, the purpose for a hearing is for the referee to analyze the facts, to analyze the witnesses, and to make findings regarding the credibility of the witnesses and the issues in dispute. I submit to you that that was not done. Third, this case involves a two-month suspension of Attorney Strauss's law license. The principal case acknowledged and relied upon by the referee is the 1995 Cyrak case, C-Y-R-A-K. That case involves a two-month suspension of a lawyer who represented a client in a bankruptcy proceedings, and during the course of that representation, on two occasions, that lawyer failed to process the bankruptcy petition, and the bankruptcy petition was dismissed by the court. In addition, that lawyer refused to cooperate with the Office of Lawyer Regulation during the course of the investigation. In fact, the record shows, of course, the record is 3 pages in length, the record shows that the lawyer had no communication with the Office of Lawyer Regulation until the matter was scheduled for hearing. That's not the case that is before this court. All of the clients that have raised questions have received their bankruptcy proceedings successfully completed. That is not an issue in this proceeding. There's an issue in this proceeding about communication, and there's an issue in this proceeding about the duty to communicate in writing regarding fees. And I again submit to the court that 20:1.5 says, 1.5b says, a lawyer shall communicate to the client in writing. It does not say that the lawyer shall get a signed written agreement. A fee agreement implies that there has been discussion and a signed document. That's what the OLR argues. That's what the referee has included in his findings. Not actually in his findings of fact. In his findings of fact, he suggests that there was an obligation to have a communication about the fees. Then he finds that there's a violation of the Supreme Court rule because there was not a written fee agreement. Justice.
Mr. Dietrich, with respect to the consequences of any findings here of a violation, isn't this the third time that the attorney has been subject to a disciplinary matter?
It is, Your Honor.
Well, what were the facts in the Syrac case?
In the first discipline, Your Honor, Attorney Strauss was given a public reprimand for violations that occurred in 2007 to 2009. Those violations related to lack of diligence, failing to keep a client informed, failing to respond to reasonable requests for information. It also involved the issuance of a false bankruptcy order. That discipline was issued involving 2007-2009 activities. There was a second public reprimand in 2011 for services that were provided during 2008 and 2009, failing to act with diligence, failing to keep a client informed, failing to comply with requests for information. But, Justice, I ask you to look further. I ask you to look further. There are four areas where OLR has brought a complaint against Attorney Strauss. The first area all relates to a piece of equipment being brought into the office of Attorney Strauss, that piece of equipment disappearing from that office, and no receipt being given for that piece of equipment when it comes in to the office. Those are trust account violations alleged. We acknowledged that, in fact, that's what happened. That's not part of the other items. That's not the same as the other items that are raised in the complaint. And in the complaint itself, it takes up literally almost a half of the complaint is focused around that particular violation. I submit that there are 30-some paragraphs in the complaint that were not necessarily to be brought, but were brought solely for the purpose of trying to create some sort of larger volume of allegations in order to bring forward some sort of heavier penalty on Attorney Strauss. I understand the concept, Justice Prosser, of progressive discipline, but it needs to be applied, Justice Prosser, within a context of a review of the comment, a review of the conduct. And part of my concern regarding any suggestion of progressive discipline is that we are putting together different types of conduct, different types of alleged violations, piling them on in order to make it look worse so that they can justify some progressive discipline. And the case relied upon by the referee, it was not a case that looked at progressive discipline. It looked at the conduct of the lawyer in having the bankruptcy petition dismissed twice while representing that client, which is, again, not what happened in the case here. I've talked about the four counts, and I've talked about the first count regarding, which actually two counts regarding the equipment. And I submit to you that a vast majority of the allegations in the complaint and in the stipulation regarding that are not relevant or necessary to the count as brought by OLR. And I have explained what I think are some of the rationale for that. The second count relates to the representation of Mr. Blischka. In the end, Mr. Blischka received his bankruptcy proceeding, and he engaged in a dispute with Attorney Strauss regarding payment of fees. And what was his answer? Let's go to Judge Judy. Let's take this to California to Judge Judy, and let's have Judge Judy decide whether I owe you any money. The court must understand that in cases like this, in representations like this, there are going to be difficult clients. The duty that a lawyer has under 1.5B is to communicate the nature of the fees and the scope of the representation. The record before the court, the record in the stipulation, the record in the trial briefs, shows that Attorney Strauss agreed initially with Mr. Blischka that the fee would be under $1,000. And our rule says you don't have to do something in writing. It can be in writing or oral. That's how the process began. The petition was filed under emergency circumstances. Mr. Blischka decided that this was a way to take advantage and get a free trip, if you will, to California to have this matter heard by Judge Judy. When you have these types of difficult clients, the communication has to be as effective as it can be, but there is no requirement that there be a written fee agreement.
Mr. Diedrich, I'm curious, was it ever heard by Judge Judy?
It was not heard by Judge Judy. Justice Attorney Strauss was smart enough not to enter into that agreement. Justice Breyer.
Now, you have Judge Judy and you have Judge Schrader. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Let me suggest, Your Honor, that I have a deep concern about how this case processed itself through the completion of the hearing and the decision of the referee. As I stated, 87% of the findings of fact are taken directly from the stipulation. And the purpose of the stipulation was to present the fundamental facts to the referee so we don't have to be litigating over the fundamental facts. So we can litigate over the real issues. There was not a true consideration of this case by the referee. I would prefer, if my choice, Justice Prosser, is the referee process or Judge Judy, I definitely select the referee process. I am a supporter of the process. I believe that we have the right process in place. But it has to be perfected. It has to be properly heard and considered.
Well, what would have been a proper hearing and consideration?
From my perspective, Chief Justice, a great deal of testimony presented by OLR as it relates to Blischka and then another witness for Blischka, Ms. White. There was a finding that Ms. White was not credible as it relates to what the initial fees were and what agreement had been reached on the fees. There were no other findings as it relates to credibility.
Did you ask to put on that testimony?
I responded and I put on the testimony of Attorney Strauss.
Right.
OLR complains because they suggest that, well, these are members of the public put on and only Attorney Strauss appeared in response. That's most reasonable and appropriate. This was an issue between a client and Attorney Strauss. Attorney Strauss gave testimony. The clients that were complaining gave testimony. But yet there were no findings of credibility. There were very limited findings of credibility. 87% of the findings of fact were from the stipulation.
Well, was they sufficient to support the ultimate legal conclusion? I mean, you have a stipulation, so you avoid effort and time and the referee can, there's no reason why the referee cannot rely on them, right?
Absolutely, Chief Justice. The purpose for the stipulation is to expedite the hearing,
right, sure,
and to provide fundamental facts.
Right.
For the referee to discern the credibility of the witnesses, to make findings regarding each of the counts, and to assess what has been given during the course of the hearing. What we have is a series of findings of fact. We have then a discussion of the penalty. We have a statement, a conclusionary statement, of finding a violation of the eight counts. No support for that finding of violations. No rationale for that other than a statement that it was concluded, that there was this finding, and then a 2.5 to 3-page discussion of the sanction. I submit to you that this court has a duty, as it does, to monitor the conduct of lawyers, to monitor the process that is used when the OLR alleges that a lawyer has violated the rules of professional conduct. And I submit to you that the process used in this proceeding was imperfect, and it cannot stand on its face to support this discipline. I submit to you the analysis and the requirement in the wordings of the referee decision that there must be a written fee agreement, not only implying, but stating within the context of it that there has to be an understanding, there has to be a signed document, is not the requirement of 20:1.5.
What is?
That there must be a written communication regarding the nature of the nature and scope of the representation and the fees to be charged. And I have submitted in my brief a number of arguments showing you in each of these cases what was submitted as a statement regarding the services to be provided. And in each case, there was a face-to-face conference between the client and Attorney Strauss, where they specifically discussed exactly what would be done as part of the representation. So to suggest that Attorney Strauss has failed because it's not a signed agreement, because it doesn't have 3 pages of detail, ignores the fact that there were specific meetings with each client in every instance where there was a discussion of the bankruptcy process, what would be done, how it would be done, what filings would be necessary. That's very clear in the record of the case, that those conferences were held and those meetings were held, and they come back and sign the bankruptcy petition documents before they can be filed. So the ability to have communications occurs on a regular basis. Again, I submit to you that in the end, the referee has relied upon one Supreme Court case with very different facts to suggest that a 2-month suspension of the lawyer's license should take place.
So what are you recommending?
I will give you, Justice Prosser, 2 recommendations. And I have thought very hard about this in the second recommendation that I make. The first recommendation, I think it's very clear, Justice Prosser, that a private reprimand is appropriate as it relates to the handling of the equipment.
Private?
Private reprimand. That is counts 1 and counts 2. I believe that the only area where the OLR has supported a case to justify a suggested violation of the rules of professional conduct is as it relates to the representation of the Jacobsons. There are many disputed facts, which I have addressed in my brief to the court. At best, Justice Prosser, a public reprimand for a failure to communicate with a client who has admitted on the record that she has memory problems and cannot remember certain meetings that we documented in testimony. The other alternative available to this court would be to do some sort of either an intensive review of the record or a remanding of this case to another referee. I don't make that recommendation lightly, but I submit to you and I submit to this court that you have a duty to monitor and oversee the entire process. And here we have not had a thorough consideration of the testimony, the statements, the record presented before the referee. I understand this court wrestles with the theory of progressive discipline, but progressive discipline applies in settings where you can connect the conduct, and there should be, in those cases, progressive discipline. I submit to you that this is not one of those cases. What OLR has done is said, we're going to charge this attorney with failing to follow the trust account rule. We're going to charge this attorney with failure to communicate. You have to look at the facts. You have to look at the connectedness of the facts. And I submit to you that there is not grounds or basis for a progressive discipline. I submit to you that there has not been a proper proceeding. There has not been a proper consideration of the contested facts to warrant that type of a conclusion in a summary review of this proceeding.
Counsel, so if I understand you, you want us to dismiss outright count two because there wasn't sufficient facts provided to sustain that count. And then in regard to count five, where Ms. White was essentially found to be not a credible witness, are you asking for that to be dismissed on that basis? Or what is your position on count five?
First, Justice Rogenczak, as it relates to count two,
it's count four.
The Blaschka matter. And
yes.
I wanted to
count
Let me address that first.
Okay.
The issue regarding the Blaschka matter is strictly as it relates to a failure to communicate regarding the nature of the fees and the nature of the representation. It's very clear that that Mr. Blaschka understood what the nature of the representation was when the parties originally met. The agreement was that the fee was going to be $975, less than the $1,000. Therefore, no requirement under the rule to have the communication in writing. Subsequently, when the agreement to do the two matters fell apart, Attorney Strauss communicated the fee is now $1,050. It's for the bankruptcy. That was in the proceedings in the correspondence from Attorney Strauss. I submit that there are grounds that would not go forward as a proved complaint. With regard to the White complaint, again, the issue in the White complaint is strictly related to communicating about fees. The record of the White case shows a number of receipts given to Ms. White regarding payments she made, shows that she said and called Attorney Strauss on several occasions, I want you to process the petition. I want you to file my bankruptcy petition. I don't have the money now. Here are my backdated checks. There clearly was an understanding about the fees. There were communication about the fees. There was not money to cash those checks. So payment was not made. The services were provided. The petition was granted. But here we are saying, well, because there wasn't a written fee agreement, there's a violation of the rules. I submit that the record does not support that. So I am asking that those not be considered by the court.
Okay, so you're not really looking so much at the credibility of the witness as you are at what you see to be a failure of proof on count five as well? Just so I understand what your position is.
I think three findings in the entire referee report is a finding that Ms. White is not credible as it relates to her position on what the fees were originally agreed to be. I am objecting significantly to the lack of findings in the record. As it relates to Ms. White, there is a finding that she's not credible as to the fee issue, and the complaint and the charge from OLR all relates to communication about fees. So I feel that has to be given weight by the court.
Okay. Thank you.
In the end, I ask the court to give consideration. I believe that this is a special case that requires your consideration. I believe that it has been imperfectly completed as part of the process before you, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrich. Mr. Ryer, representing, good morning, the Office of Lawyer Regulations.
Sometimes in lawsuits, and because I've been a trial lawyer all my life,
counsel,
always two different stories.
Counsel.
Can you hear me?
I'm a senior citizen. Got to speak up here.
And
I'm a senior citizen also, so I'll do my best. Can you hear me now all right?
I think you need to raise the podium because it will put the mic more in appropriate level with your mouth. It should be on your left-hand side.
Doing it.
How's this?
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. That may be helpful.
And
okay.
If you will speak more slowly, that is also helpful. And in front of the microphone.
We're so picky this morning.
Well, since my family, my son is hearing impaired, and so I'm very aware of that, and talking slowly really helps. So I'll do my best. And I'm very conscientious about
now.
That. And mine is also in that situation. As I said, this is really two different stories, apparently, about a process and the substance of what happened. And what I think the important thing is the theme and the construct of what's really happened. If we look at it, there's always a story that evolves. In this particular story, it started in around 2009, February, important date. Mr. Strauss had been practicing law for almost 18 years. Experienced lawyer, bankruptcy was his specialty, high volume TV ads, a lot of competition. So in 2009, he was then suspended by Judge Shapiro in bankruptcy court for conduct that occurred in 2008 and 9, specifically creating false discharge orders for a court, lying to the client, covering up at a motion hearing where he should have told about his creation of the false discharge order. So in February of 2009, Judge Shapiro ordered a 6-month suspension from practicing in that court. Now, that's an important date because all the conduct that's referred to in the OLR complaint, which is the subject of the referee's findings of fact and conclusions of law, occurred after Mr. Strauss had received this suspension, and that suspension also formed the basis of a public reprimand that you are referring to in 2010. So at the time in 2009, when he first represented Mr. Ashai in the fuel monitoring case, that was in June of 2009, he was under that suspension for those egregious conducts that was referred to by Judge Shapiro taking that action. So in 2009, in June, He represents Mr. Ashai, and Ridgestone Bank has given him notice of an interest in this process of the equipment, fuel monitoring equipment, in order to sell a piece of gas station property that they had on a mortgage foreclosure. And Mr. Dietrich and Mr. Strauss have kind of minimized that case. But remember, he was basically on kind of a formal probation here of you can't do these things and violate any conduct of the rules here, especially when you've just been on a suspension covering 6 months. So what does he do? He actually files a petition in that bankruptcy court while he's suspended involving the fuel monitoring equipment and representing Mr. Ashai. So what we have here in the form of progressive discipline, we have the rules of Mr. Strauss, we have the rules of this court, and we have the rules of the bankruptcy court. So what rules are we going to follow? So in this particular situation, in the summer of 2009 and the fall of 2009, efforts were made by the Ridgestone Bank and a court counsel and the receiver to simply get possession of this equipment. They had a qualified buyer, and they lost that opportunity because Mr. Strauss chose not to give them the equipment. And then finally, Mr. Brandolino, the receiver, appeared in November at Mr. Strauss's office because he had not responded to their request to give them the equipment. And then Mr. Strauss gives Mr. Brandolino four different answers as to where is this equipment. And, of course, it was never produced. At the time of that conference in November 2009, remember, this is all a guilty plea that Mr. Strauss entered 3 days before the hearing. So this is not any disputed fact from the standpoint of a guilty plea. And that was the words used by Mr. Dietrich in the stipulation that Mr. Strauss pled guilty to those two counts. So when that happened in 2009 in November, Mr. Strauss told Brandolino, I'll take care of it, I'll be responsible for it. And then when he asked to get this done, Mr. Burnett, the lawyer for the bank, he basically would not agree to pay for it. The dance continued, and then he blamed the town realty, which is the landlord of his law office, for this.
Counsel, this is an interesting narrative. But I'm looking at the counts associated with this episode, counts 1 and 2. Count 1, that Attorney Strauss violated the provision that requires the lawyer shall clearly identify and appropriately safeguard other property of a client or third party. That, I believe, constitutes count 1. Count 2, the Attorney Strauss stipulated that by failing to provide a signed written receipt describing the fuel monitoring equipment he had taken into custody on the date of the receipt, he violated 20.8 sub B, count 2. And so the narrative, I say, is interesting, but if we focus on the counts, I don't see in the record where he ever denied the whole purpose of issuing a receipt is so that the person who has received the item of value cannot later deny that they received it. And I don't think he ever said he didn't have possession of this fuel monitoring system.
Well, it depends on which version. He said he had it in June. He said he had it 2 weeks ago. He said he had it 4 months ago. That's what he told Brandolino. The date of the receipt would have been important because then you'd have the date he actually did possess the property.
Well, what difference? I mean, if he never denied having it, and the different versions that I'm aware of, and I stand to be educated, include that the item had either been misplaced or stolen by the cleaning crew. It's not a difficult stretch of the imagination, given the description of his practice, as you said in your opening comments, a high volume, and by the regular flat fee he charges at $1,050, this is a high volume practice that relies on a lot of people coming. So I'm saying he never denied having the equipment. And He never denied that the equipment was exactly what they said it was. So I guess if we're looking at form, did he provide the receipt? Did he appropriately safeguard it? I don't know. How did he not appropriately safeguard it?
Well, he pled guilty to the account. Yeah. He did not safeguard the property when he had a duty to do so.
Accounting, and is the plea based on res ipsa loquitur? Because it's not available, therefore, he didn't safeguard it.
No, he had a duty to do it, and he failed to do it, and he admitted he'd failed to do it by his guilty plea, and he must take the consequences for that. And there was a factual basis for that in the stipulation of facts.
So what is the factual basis?
Factual basis is 40 paragraphs to show that he came into contact with that possession of that equipment and failed to safeguard it, so the bank lost an opportunity.
Did you say 40 to 50 paragraphs?
Well, I'm talking about the stipulation of facts.
I mean, if it takes 40 to 50 paragraphs to say why someone didn't safeguard property, that sounds rather complicated to me.
No, it was just the emails and correspondence that Mr. Burnett was trying to get the equipment from Mr. Strauss, which he did not provide him.
But it was equipment that he never denied receiving, and his explanations may have evolved over time. You say they changed, they shifted. Is it possible that with his high-volume practice, he wouldn't know where that equipment might have been or how it disappeared? I'm just curious about the facts.
Well, the facts are is that Mr. Ashai and Mr. Strauss, in the summer of 2009, they didn't tell the bank where that property was. There was unclear, and the bank was trying to get the property to sell this gas station. Without it, the gas station's going nowhere. They lost a ton of money when they couldn't get a buyer because at that time there was no buyer without the fuel monitoring equipment. It's an integral part of the property. So what happens here is that in the fall of 2009 is when Burnett again asked Mr. Strauss to give him the equipment, and he doesn't give it to him. And then that's when Mr. Brandolino goes on announcing, we need this equipment, and that's when he gave him four different answers. And then he blamed the people at Town Realty, and so he kept blaming other people rather than himself. In his answer, they were defending this from the beginning. They only entered into this plea of guilty 3 days before the hearing. This was all an answer denying all this stuff until we hit the 3 days before trial.
Well, it's not uncommon for pleas to be entered on the eve of trial or the day of trial.
Well, I understand.
Why do you keep hammering that home as if that's something that we should? What do you want us to infer from that?
All I'm saying is that this particular, if you look at the chronology, and I'd like to move to get to the next issue because it's really relevant to what he did or didn't do on the communication. This is all about lack of communication, because in the fall of 2009 is when he was representing the Jacobsons. While he was under the suspension order, he filed another bankruptcy petition for the Jacobsons when he was told not to. So now that's part of the public reprimand when the Jacobsons were involved with a representation. In July of 2009, that's when the representation occurred. And between July of 2009 and April of 2010, according to the referee's findings, he failed to communicate with his clients to explain to them the matter, to use the means to obtain the objectives they were seeking, failed to identify and consult with them on the matter which could lead them to make an informed decision, failed to respond to any of their requests. All of those were specific findings on paragraphs 90 to 94 in his findings. Paragraph 80 is a very important paragraph because he makes the findings in paragraph 80, specific findings that Mr. Strauss was not credible in his testimony related to the scope of representation, which involved the student loan. The student loan was an important part of the representation. Mrs. Jacobson had a $100,000 student loan debt. She wanted help on that. He represented to her in the initial port of contact that he was experienced on it. Turns out he was not experienced on it. Turns out they paid $1,500. They got a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, but he never fulfilled his responsibilities on the student loan, as found by the referee, him, Mr. Strauss, not being credible, paragraph 80, and in paragraphs 90 to 94, did not have any contact with the Jacobsons in violation of either all those rules, for which he concluded it was a violation of those rules.
Counselor, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about count 5, which is Yolanda White's count. And what is concerning me about that is something similar to what I asked Attorney Dietrich. The court made a specific finding, or the referee made a specific finding, that she was not credible. And I want to know what evidence in regard to the count that was charged is there that would override the credibility finding. So she testified and referee found her not credible. What I want to know is, what do you think supports that count that is sufficient to override the referee's specific finding that she was not credible?
Well, let's talk about the rule violation and the credibility question. The rule violation is whether or not he provided a sufficient or a written communication of the scope of representation and the rate or basis of the fee and expenses. The only credibility determination the referee made was related to the initial representation where she claimed it was $500 for the representation. And then later on, 6 weeks later, 5 weeks later, he sends an invoice to her in the amount of $1,050. And the referee found that that invoice of $1,050 5 weeks later was not in compliance with the rule under 1.5 because that had nothing to do with the initial credibility issue. It was in excess of $1,000. And then the referee made the finding that there was no agreement between her, Mr. Strauss, as to the $1,050. He made a finding that her initial representation claim of $500 was not credible. But that doesn't mean the other part of her testimony, where she testified as to Mr. Strauss's harassing phone calls, 13 in one day, which resulted in her contacting the police and then finally entering into payments for that amount. So the credibility issue was on the initial representation.
Okay, is the count based on harassment or is the count based on lack of a, quote, written agreement?
Lack of a written communication because what the whole
now,
point...
You're changing words on me, and I'll take you back to opposing counsel's argument. His argument is written communication is different than a written agreement. Because a written agreement implies two parties are going to sign a document that's in writing. So you can choose whichever you believe the rule requires, but I want you to be consistent about how you argue to me because it mixes me up if you're not.
Well,
are you talking about a written agreement? Because that was the question that you was asked. Was there any written agreement? Okay. Now, a written communication can be one-sided. I could send you a letter and put all sorts of stuff in it, and I would have communicated with you in writing. But we may not have a written agreement by that communication. So I just want to be clear on what you're comfortable using, and then I'll rely on that as a.
If you look at the findings on paragraph 70, he indicates that there was a finding that there was a question asked during the testimony related to whether or not there was a document that Mr. Strauss had that would show a written communication of the scope of representation, a document showing that agreement. And the answer was no. And what happened in that particular instance was, keep in mind, it was Mr. Strauss's duty to prepare and to give a written communication to the client, Yolanda White. And so in that particular instance, referee found that he did not provide that written communication, and if you look at his testimony in the record, he, Mr. Strauss, testified that he did have written fee agreements with his clients. He didn't have one to produce for this particular individual, Yolanda White, for the hearing,
and
never could.
Was that required under, what I'm trying to understand is,
in your view, is that required under the rule? Is a communication sufficient, or do you have to have a signed written agreement?
The referee did not make any finding and conclusions that it was a requirement of a signed fee agreement. That is not the case. And Mr. Dietrich has alluded to that as some sort of finding. That was never the finding that he made. In fact, the questions were framed as to whether or not there was an agreement which could then be confirmed in writing, which supports the rule.
Well, I look at the question, and I don't have the whole record before me, just parts. But she was asked, was there any written agreement entered into between you and Mr. Strauss? And then there are dates there. Now, a written agreement can be interpreted to mean I signed it and you signed it. So we have an agreement that's in writing, and both of our assents to that agreement are apparent. A written communication can be one-sided. Now, it may evidence an agreement, or it may not. My concern is, does the written communication have to be signed by both people, or is a one-sided communication enough under the rule? What do you think?
Well, our position is it's not under the rules required that it's a signed written agreement. But there must be a written agreement that confirms the agreement and an invoice. See, under this whole case, the presentation on the defense has been an invoice suffices as a written communication. If you look back on all the ethics committee reviews and all the ethics opinions on the change of the law, change of the rule, there's no reference to the invoice satisfying that written communication requirement. What's really happened here is the position of the respondent here, Mr. Strauss, is taking us back before 2007. Because now we're talking about there is no basic agreement in writing communicated to the client. It's in the old days, it was preferably in writing. In the 2007, it now talks about scope, which it didn't do before. It now talks about changes, which it didn't do before. It talks about putting it shall, mandatory, in writing, communicated before representation or a reasonable time after. And if you'll note here in Bletchka and in Jacobson and in Yolanda White, these invoices occurred 5-6 weeks after the initial representation.
Well, the invoices, do they define sufficiently the scope of representation or just the price for the representation?
They don't even reference any of these invoices don't even reference the scope of the matter. In Bletchka's case, Exhibit 35, it just says, what do you owe, $1,050. And remember, this is really important in this case, is because both Strauss and Bletchka admitted in their testimony there was never agreement between Strauss and Bletchka to the $1,050. Strauss admitted in his testimony he issued that Exhibit 35 because he was angry at Mr. Bletchka for not agreeing to the amounts that he wanted. That's an anger statement. That's not an agreement under the rules to communicate with clients. An anger statement does not suffice. That's not a 1.5 satisfaction. Absolutely not. And all of this is happening, remember, while he has now gotten a public reprimand related to his false discharges, while he's had this suspension from the federal court. And so then he has another public reprimand in 2011 for the same conduct. The referee really does, I think, a very good job of analyzing the fact that he was on notice, basically, prior misconduct, repeated misconduct. He gave the factors that you consider in progressive discipline, the factors you give consideration in imposing or recommending a discipline. He has given everything that you're required to do. What Mr. Strauss is asking the referee to do is something, in his view, make it more explicit, make it more necessary. It's a slippery slope. Who is to define that, Mr. Strauss? No, it's the referee's job. There's an extensive record here upon which he based his decisions and outlined what his credibility determination was on Mr. Strauss in the Jacobson case. And it's clear from seeing the conclusions of law and the facts that he also cited with the complaints by OLR related to his failure to provide a sufficient written communication so that it would avoid confusion, litigation, exactly what we're here today. This could have been avoided easily by a written memorandum. If you look at the ethics opinion and even the follow-up articles in the journal, in the bar journal, in fact, by Mr. Dietrich and Mr. Pierce, talking about what is a sufficient writing. And the ethics opinion is talking about a memorandum, some sort of customary fee agreement, which Mr. Strauss had, but he didn't use in this case or any of these cases. So what we have is the referee really did analyze all this. And under the Padgett case, if the referee is there to hear the evidence, there's no dispute, no recognition here that he didn't hear it. He's to then examine the documentation. There's no allegation here that he didn't examine the documentation. There are 115 exhibits. And then he has to reach a finding on disputes, which he did. He has satisfied his requirements under the Padgett case. So if you satisfy those requirements and you've made credibility determinations in order to get to those findings, and then you concluded as a matter of law that these violations occurred, if they all have, there is no point in doing regressive discipline, which is exactly what is being advocated here. If there was ever a case for progressive discipline to at least a 60-day suspension to change behaviors, we're into changing behaviors here. Rule Strauss versus rule of the court. He has followed his own rules from the bankruptcy court into the state, into these representations, whether it's Jacobson in the form of failure to communicate, and then he comes up with this January meeting in 2010 and a memorandum which is never documented, never supported, and you find the referee basically not believing that because he, in paragraphs 90 to 94, cite exactly the testimony of Mrs. Jacobson in support of those findings. And he made a specific reference on paragraph 80 that Mr. Strauss was not credible on the student loan. So what more can you do? You've made the findings. You've examined the evidence. You've heard the testimony. There's no issue here that there wasn't. Somehow there's some reference that the process was wrong. This is not a due process issue here. I don't know what constitutionally. He had a full hearing from the beginning to the end. From all the motions he made to all the opportunities to answer, the stipulations that I provided and prepared, and then 3 days before the guilty plea, and he had 4 days of hearing. There was never any objection that he wasn't getting a fair shake. He had an opportunity to bring his witnesses to support his position. He chose not to for whatever reason. All the people that testified for OLR had documentation to support the OLR complaints. He had none. Zero.
Here's my question. Seems to me, if I'm hearing both counsel today, Mr. Diedrich's position is that there should be a written communication. And Mr. Diedrich has an opportunity to correct me. And the referee found or made a conclusion of law about a written agreement. And if I'm hearing it right, the violation of the section, according to Mr. Diedrich, deals with a failure to communicate. And the referee found a failure to reach an agreement. So if I agreed to do services for $900 and I'm going to do such and such a services, and I wrote the client that, and the client did not sign it or otherwise indicate an agreement other than the representation continued. Is that a violation of this statute? It's, what, 5.1b?
So 1.5?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 1.5. Okay. 1.5b1.
It's our view. Well,
the other part of my question is, was this discussed before the referee, this difference between communication and agreement? I mean, was this a big deal below, assuming it's a big deal here?
Well, in the post-hearing briefs, it was extensive. And then the referee decided, following the post-hearing briefs, his report. So it was considered at that time. And by the way, this was extensively briefed and litigated. This was not a walk in the park.
Okay.
So he had ample opportunity to do that. And what we're saying is an invoice. I can send an invoice to anybody for any amount. It doesn't mean anything. The whole point of the change in the rules, as you know, being an integral part of this process, was to develop better communication to avoid confusion, avoid lawsuits, avoid litigation, like we are here. It was designed for a written communication. Without an agreement, what is good about a communication in an invoice? I could send an invoice for $5,000, but if it isn't an agreement...
If I understand your answer, counsel, and I think the Chief Justice and I are having a similar problem with the way words are used. You just said... You use the word agreement interposed with the word communication. Mr. Dietrich is much more precise on what he thinks the rule requires. The Chief Justice and I both were focusing on point 5, parent B, parent 1, parent require a written agreement where both parties are signing it, or is a communication sufficient so long as the communication represents the party's agreement.
Yes, there's no requirement for a signed agreement.
Okay, so it's a communication, and when you talk about agreement, what you mean is what he sent out didn't evidence a meeting of the minds of the parties. So he wasn't communicating what the parties had in their oral interactions agreed to.
Well stated.
Correct?
Very well stated.
Okay, all right, I understand what you're saying.
Very well stated. And so I think I've got a red light here, so I think I'm done.
Any further questions?
Did anyone else have any other questions of me?
No.
Okay.
Apparently not. Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present our position. Have a good day.
This is one story. This is the story of the Office of Lawyer Regulation saying we need to put together as big a record as we can be because we think that this attorney is not paying attention to us. Critical point. This time we spent regarding what happened with the equipment, I think has already been acknowledged as unnecessary. The hammering on this notion of a suspension from the bankruptcy court incorrectly states what that suspension was. Judge Shapiro said, you gave a false document to a client. You may not practice in my court for 6 months. He didn't say you can't file any petitions, didn't say you can't participate in any court proceedings. If you carefully read what that conclusion was, everything that Attorney Strauss did during this time that we're going to bash him for having some difficult clients was acceptable under that rule. I was part of the discussions regarding 20:1.5b. I was very concerned during those discussions about exactly what I'm hearing, written fee agreement. When we came to this court to debate and discuss the new rule changes in 2007, the clear presentation to the court was this must be a written communication. And every lawyer has every different type of communication to their clients. I ask you to consider the facts of this case, where in each instance there's a clear meeting and discussion of what the nature of bankruptcy is, what the scope of representation is, what it means to file a petition, what you have to go through to sign the various petitions. In each of the communications with White and Jacobson and Blischka, there were communications in writing about the fee.
Where is the communication with White? What are you relying on for the communication that satisfies the rule with regard to Yolanda White?
There was an invoice sent to White that described what the representation was going to be, albeit perhaps not very explicit, and there was an indication of the fee that was going to be charged.
I assume that's an exhibit that I can go look at and see if I think the description of the services is sufficient, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would point out to the court that the exhibits, suggestion here that there were no exhibits by Attorney Strauss, is an inaccurate description of the record before the referee. There was an extensive piece of litigation on this case, testimony given over the course of the 4 days by OLR witnesses and by Attorney Strauss in responding to each of the counts. The understanding was at the time in 2007 that this court approved the change to 1.5B is we were one of the first states to mandate a written communication. That's not in the ABA model rules even today.
Well, that's the question I was going to ask, because there's no citation in these briefs any non-Wisconsin material, as far as I can find.
There is no other state that has the written communication.
What do the other states have?
It's all the model rule, which may be in writing. And it is, I think, in fact stated, it is recommended that it be in writing. But this court has already stated and clearly understands that there are best practices, and we try to incorporate best practices into our practice.
Mr. Diedrich, when you say other states recommend it be in writing, are you talking about a communication about fees and scope of representation or an agreement about
a communication fees? About fees, Chief Justice. The concept is always communication about fees.
In the model code.
Yes. Okay. This court, in the effective January 1 of 2015, did modify the limited scope representation rule to talk about something signed by a client. That's not what we're about here today. That is something that was a specific change in the rule for that purpose and that purpose only. This is a case where the referee and the Office of Lawyer Regulation have used the word written fee agreement. And I was very sensitive to that. And yes, that was very much argued before the referee. And you will see in the findings by the referee, not the findings of fact, but the decision by the referee in each instance uses the word written fee agreement.
Well, that's what I was looking at. And that's if I've got it correct, you should tell me. It's on pages 18 and maybe a page missing here. 18 and 20.
That's correct, Your Honor, Chief Justice. On 18, page 20,
18 and 20,
sub 5.
That's right. And that's what you're referring to. Written fee agreement. That's right.
That's correct. That's correct.
That's what I thought.
Chief
okay.
I indicate my time is up. I ask you to consider the position that I presented with regard to the costs of the litigation. Yes, Chief Justice.
Justice.
Is there an obligation that the client sign some sort of communication or agreement?
There is not, Justice Prosser. There is not in the rule. Is that a best practice? Certainly many would argue and suggest that that's a best practice. That is not a requirement of the rule, but for your amendment that took place January 1 of 2015 to get a presumption of the appropriateness of limited scope representation. That's a new requirement in the rules. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrich, and thank you, Mr. Ryer, for your arguments today. And these are always very difficult cases for the court, as you all know, and we appreciate both your coming, and we appreciate your being here. With that, I will close the
oral argument on 2013 AP 1619 D, OLR versus Strauss. The court will meet in conference, and I had set it up for 10:30, which gives you about 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
I had set it on the agenda for 10:30, and it gives you about 15 minutes to gather the materials, etc.